I chose these two stories very particularly. Again, like for the Poe thing, there was a deliberate stress on two different kinds of things. These two stories will get you into the two major areas of Hawthorne's work. That's why they were chosen. And that is through the my kinsman Major Molyneux, all the ways in which Hawthorne, a mid-19th century American writer, uses the American colonial experience as his basic instance for fiction. Of course, the great novel, The Scarlet Letter, of 1850 is the masterpiece. That is a very great book, but I'll try and lecture on that, you see, next term, you know, or like sometime during your 2-year thing. So I thought we'd concentrate on the stories. But in The Scarlet Letter, there is a direct usage of what one might call a colonial Puritan eastern seaboard experience, you know, Massachusetts and that New England area. But the tricky problem is, again and again, he is using it. It is not like, you understand, direct reportage or documentary or something like that. So what you've got is a mid-19th century American using earlier materials of his own country, you see. And you know, like, when you get what is called a historical novel, it's always contemporary. You know, I mean, like, I don't know, Gone with the Wind isn't really about the Civil War. It's about, like, how Hollywood wants to go with permissiveness. And things of that kind. You really sort of like go inside the novel to see what's going on. So that, again and again, the Puritan Eastern American experience will be an opportunity for a mid-19th century man to talk about the relationship between government, the state, democracy, and the individual. Because clearly the Puritan theocracy of New England focuses very much on the state saying, I am the law, and therefore I am suggesting coercion for your own good. So you get that kind of structure. So all the time then, the idea of personal conscience, of the self, of the position of the body in the body of the state, and so on. All these major themes were brought into the 19th century, so that heroes and heroines will be, as it were, instances of the romantic impulse to identity, discussing the self, through the tension between the self and the community in the 17th century. You see that kind of thing? And actually, this is not—it's not quite true about my kinsman Major Molyneux, because it's more like the colonial experience in general. But I mean, I'm stretching a bit here. In actual fact, as you will see in the first in the first paragraph, he says that this happens not far from 100 years ago. Well, this story is about 1832, so that dates it to 1732, shall we say? But even then, it's still colonial experience, of course. Although the Puritan thing is becoming modified, you see. But it's still like the colonial era, okay? Right, now the other kind of story which is major in Hawthorne is exemplified by the birthmark, which is what you might call his science fiction. What you would call science fiction, in fact. And that is stories about the ways in which science transforms environment for what purposes. And if the environment includes other human beings, you have a double moral issue. So that there are stories like The Birthmark and another one called Rappaccini's Daughter, which are about nut scientists, you know, who are sort of like fiddling around with nature and human nature. And Hawthorne is interested in what this means. It's one of his major themes. And of course it goes right through to the present day. This is a major 19th and 20th century literary theme, is it not? Like, what happens if you give permission to the scientist, the scientist, when he is given permission by society to control nature and human nature for social social purposes, I mean, either technological or governmental, you see, putting his ability at the disposal of other people and stuff. And this, the story, the birthmark, of course, is very much along those lines. It's a man setting up an experimental program in which a human being is caught, his wife, in fact, for perfectionist purposes, isn't she, you see, in the story. This is a very, this is a very crucial 19th century type of fiction, which goes right on the 19th century and involves, like, the position of science improving on what is already there in the environment. When I say improving, like, I better put inverted commas around it, because obviously half the story is about the fact that they don't. Which is where the, like, the science fiction thing comes out, right? Again and again and again. There's all movies about this, you know, like stories. And of course there's a huge American tradition, but there's a British tradition too, which goes from, I don't know, from Gothic novels right through H.G. Wells, you know. So we're into big standing ground here, huh? So that's the kind of thing, that's the reason I chose these two. So you can use them as entries into Hawthorne quite well. I mean, there's a great deal of this fiction which you can handle. I mean, there's stories like Rappaccini's Daughter about the scientist, and there's in the story called The Artist of the Beautiful. It's about this man who tries to make a mechanical butterfly, which has the perfection and beauty of the actual butterfly, except it's human-made. You see, this kind of urge towards, it's to do with all those, what's always fascinated with is all the ways in which one of the things you call human is the creative act, which makes something which isn't in nature, you see. For scientists and artists are involved, not only scientists, do you understand what I mean? It's not only the artists, it's the scientists. It's the, what is the nature of the creative act that makes it sometimes, using old-fashioned terms, hubristic? That is, that somehow it seems to place human beings in a position of government over nature and human nature, which is dangerous, or blasphemous, or some such word, you know, hubristic in that sense. You see what I'm saying? This kind of thing. Okay, well, let's go right into My Kinsman Major Minor, in the same way as I did it last time, you know. All these things are introductory, so I'm not trying to read the story for you. I'm trying to indicate, largely by concentrating on the opening paragraph, you probably noticed, how to look for the same. You'll notice in that opening paragraph of My Kinsman Major Minor, a lot of the stuff is already there. And the opening sentence, after the kings of Great Britain had assumed the right of appointing the colonial governors, and it's that word assumed that one gets to. There's this, like, question of assumed rights and other kinds of rights. And this is a very political story. And then you get the people look with most jealous scrutiny to the exercise of power, which did not emanate from themselves. And you've got, here again, you've got the people, the power, and so on. So it's a political power structure we're going to move into, to do with the people and rulers, which is a major theme in Hawthorne. And in fact, that's why he's a major American writer as well as a major writer. And then, and they usually rewarded their rulers with slender gratitude. And if you know the story that's coming at all, when you read it the second time around, you'll see that this is a major thing too. And so on. He's building up, in the first paragraph, enough historical context so that the thing is not just purely a psychological story of human relationships. In a very local sense, it has a broader context in history. And then we have references to the annals of Massachusetts Bay and about the condition of six governors in 40 years who came to sticky ends of various kinds. So he's concerned here with all those ways in which, before the Declaration of Independence in America, tensions were set up by imposed British government and the people who are already incipiently feeling themselves to be in some way detached from rule from across the ocean, you see. When I say incipient, I mustn't be too hefty about this and pushy, because we're by no means talking about some already created American national identity which is being defended, do you understand? You see how careful one must be, because Okay, in the by the 1730s, there are writers in America who, in a pretty generalized, incipient way, are beginning to feel what later will be recognized as the element of independence. I can't put it any more like that than that, you see. So be careful about this, because this story does deal with what later on will become detachment, revolution, you see. Revolutionary detachment, right? Of American people from the British rulers and those in America who still held allegiance to those British rulers. So be careful, so that when we get Hawthorne saying the remaining two, as well as the sixth, till the revolution were favoured with few and brief intervals of peaceful sway. Clearly, this is a pre-revolutionary short story, and pre-revolutionary situations are always like now and then you have peace, now and then you have conflict. See, this is what he's getting at. So already there's this like unstable position, isn't there, being described at the beginning, you see. So there's political instability about colonial affairs. And then in the second paragraph, the thing immediately starts to become not just like historical documentation, but the fictional element. And I mean by that it's in one of these old and recurrent situations of crossing a frontier, crossing a barrier of some kind, crossing some actual and also symbolic limit. It was near 9 o'clock of a moonlit evening when a boat crossed the ferry with a single passenger, and so on. So he's moving in, and he's moving in, and it has another major theme in Hawthorne and in American literature, he's moving in from the country into the town. And let me just say, quite point blank, without going into it in any detail until we get more information between us on this, that the city-country tensions in American culture and American fiction are very strong, right through until the present day. And they still are very strong. I mean, voting matters in America are very much governed by the rural vote and the town vote and the inequities here, and the farm vote and so on, that is very strong. These tensions between the country and the town are very, very much, and of course in the Romantic period, as you well know, we've been having a go at this, some of you and me, earlier this afternoon, a great deal of what is called Romanticism in the 19th century is very much anti-city, is it not? You know, to do with like the viable area seems to be trees, clouds, grass, rocks, you know, this away from the city area, shall we say. But the process here is moving into the city, you see, of this boy. Again, it's the young man who's barely 18. And this is another one of these situations where you've got the crossing over on the ferry, the crossing of the limits there, the movement from the town to the country. And the other situation is, of course, the young man on the threshold. So already you have the revolutionary program, you see, the incipient revolutionary program in the first paragraph. Do you understand? Do you see what I'm saying? And then in the second part, the young man who is in this situation, who is crossing from the town, from the country to the town, who is barely 18. You see, this is where it starts. And this is where it's going to continue. So what one wants to look for is the way Hawthorne so beautifully handles this kind of informational structuring, to build it out so that the young man in some way will in fact begin to understand his position. That's what the story is about, isn't it? It's a story about incipient understanding of incipient revolution. You know, it isn't like the guy is followed on like a revolution or something of that kind. It's to do with this young man's understanding beginning to develop. So in the last sentence we get that gentleman who befriends him with him, and there's a kind of equation of balance. It's typical of Hawthorne that when he writes that he doesn't want to get out tight, conclusive resolutions. Again and again and again, he wants to get the reader to a state where the information is there and the decision is to be made. Do you see? He's not one of these tight guys who wants closed structures with only one answer. So at the end, you don't get an either-or situation. You get a double situation of both. So you get Robin planning to go back on the ferry. I begin to grow weary of town life, sir. Will you show me the way to the ferry? And the man says, no, my good friend Robin, not tonight at least. Some few days hence, if you wish it, I will speed you on your journey. Or, if you prefer to remain with us, perhaps as you are a shrewd youth, you may rise in the world without the help of your kinsman, Major Molyneux. And here is like a whole series of potentials, do you see, in the final paragraph, suggesting, okay, don't rush back to the country. Maybe you can learn what you use, and like without the help of your kinsman, Major Molyneux, who by this time, of course, is established as the British ruler, who the local people in this town are rebelling against. The invitation is him to repudiate his linkage with the past and Britain and become an American. That's the loaded thing at the end, but it's an invitation. Because Hawthorne knows darn well that it was by no means a foregone conclusion that a young man's situation would choose that way. In fact, a lot of young men didn't, you see, so he can't betray the facts of history. Do you understand what I'm saying to that? Do it, I mean, do like say things to me if you feel there's anything I'm not doing properly. So that's it. That's the kind of that's like the structure, you see, of the thing. I think one can like say that. You see the kind of plot structure it is, and also the time. Notice a lot of Hawthorne's most effective scenes take place at night in his stories generally, or they give the impression of taking place at night. Now I'm not trying to be stupid here. I mean that it's notorious in Hawthorne that using a word from the art, from the visual art, that he has an interest in what is called chiaroscuro, and that is like the play of light and dark within a scene, you know? He's a very strongly visual writer, and again, the visual scene with its light play, its chiaroscuro, particularly moonlight and darkness, and the flicker of reality, you see, rather than the stability of reality, is the political and psychological and social meaning, quality, rather, of the experience. It's like the setting becomes the indication of the quality of the experience. The fact that in the story, continually, you notice, the town is a sort of labyrinth. Do you notice? But it keeps getting lost. The streets cross all the time. Do you see? And it's night time. And the figures, faces appear at upper windows in flickering light. Do you see? It is like the experiential, not only the experience of setting, but it's the experience itself. The decor is really not just like backdrop, but it is the environmental psychology. You see? What I'm saying, like that. And he's very good at this, his Hawthorne. Again and again, his best stories. I mean, for instance, you'll see, if you don't remember it already, in The Scarlet Letter, one of the crucial scenes takes place in the forest, and the sunlight flickering down through the trees and the dense foliage is part of the kind of experience that's been conveyed. You know, it's like light and dark together. Do you see what I'm saying? So, and that is like a decision area psychologically in the play, in the plot too. So that's the kind of other thing you might look at here. Also, in both Robin's case and the case of his kinsman Major Molyneux, another motif that concerns Hawthorne an awful lot, and that is again a theme very much concerned with the Romantic period, but intensified, I think, in America, and that is tensions between the individual and the community at the level of a considerable rebellion and opposition. Hawthorne is very concerned with isolated men and women, and somehow human beings who, in a situation that is supposed to be a democratic community, can't make it for some reason. Religious, sexual, political, and being a scientist, you know, therefore having the kind of superior knowledge which majority don't have, and so on. All this, and the artist, of course, is crucial. And Hawthorne felt this very strongly because he was an artist himself. And the whole, I mean, artists necessarily in a democratic structure tend to feel that their ability is in some way linked to things that other people don't have. Yeah, maybe they shouldn't, but they do, in fact. So there's that to be considered here. I mentioned the opposition to the town and country thing, so we've got that already. That, watch that symbolic setting of light and shade psychologically. Well, and I mentioned about the labyrinth kind of structure of the town. As soon as he gets there, you notice, it occurred to him that he knew not whither to direct his steps. And then he asked the way, and asked for his kinsman Major Molyneux's dwelling. And immediately, people stop work and come and look at him. And when he goes on his hastens away, as the phrase, there's this ill-mannered roar of laughter follows him. And throughout the story, probably there's this laughter keeps following him. And there's like this element of strong ridicule attached to the fact he is the kinsman in this mysterious way of Molyneux. And that is that he is in the position of having a kinsman who is discredited, and he has to make decisions about this very slowly. But he doesn't understand the beginning at all. So we get this, and then as soon as that little experience is finished about the people in the barbershop laughing at him, remember, we get he now became entangled in a succession of crooked and narrow streets which crossed each other, you see, so the thing continued. So the setting, as it is like in Kafka and in Dickens and other major writers, in the 19th century particularly, the city tends to become a labyrinth for. It's an instance of the experience, and it is the experience, and it tends to symbolize the kind of experience that's involved. So that's the kind of thing you want to watch there. Then he goes into a tavern, which is described in terms of like smoke and dark corners, and then a kind of flickering of people coming into the light, whispered conversations, and so on. This sort of sense that he's moving into a strange area of half-concealed life, do you see? This kind of way. And then in the tavern there's this extraordinary person, and the word grotesque is used. His whole face left a deep impression on me. His forehead bulged out into double prominence with a veil between. The nose came boldly forth in an irregular curve, and his bridge was more than a finger's breadth. The eyebrows were deep and shaggy and so on. And this an image of the fire, the eyes glowing like the fire. There's this extraordinary figure that he comes across for the first time. But the atmosphere in the tavern, again, is of ironic courtesy, which finally breaks into a kind of hostility against it. And Robin says, Robin feels this, and Hawthorne says, a strange hostility in every countenance induced him to relinquish his purpose of breaking the courteous innkeeper's head. The violence is just kept in. And then he goes out of the street again, and then there's this, the light of the moon and the lamps in the numerous shop windows, and then the darkness. And the whole city thing again. What else can I do? Then he goes into this rather narrow street, which, being a country boy and pretty inexperienced, he doesn't realize at all is a sort of brothel area, and all these girls around, coming out into the moonlight. And again, the laughter, and again the association of Major Molyneux here. The woman said he dwells here in order to get Robin in. But he's being had again. Then the watchman tells him to go home. Home, vagabond, home, or you'll be in the stocks, he says. And as Robin says, a second hint of this kind. And there he's left in darkness again. And again that laughter. A pleasant titter saluted him from the open window above his head. And he says, another figure. You see how the structure is. And then we get, he now roamed desperately and at random through the town, almost ready to believe that a spell was on him. This confusion, bewilderment. And then suddenly, finally, this opening section ends where somebody says to him, watch here an hour and Major Molyneux will pass by. and it's that same figure he's met earlier in the tavern who will appear again. And this time, notice how he is. The forehead with its double prominence, the broad hooked nose, the shaggy eyebrows and the fiery eyes were those which he had noticed at the inn. But the man's complexion had undergone a singular, or more probably a twofold change. One side of his face blazed an intense red. You want to visualize this very strongly if you read it. One side of his face blazed an intense red, while the other was black as midnight. The division line being in the broad bridge of the nose, and a mouth which seemed to extend from ear to ear was black or red in contrast to the colour of the cheeks. So like the black side of the face has the red mark going up, you see, and the red side has the black mark going up. Right. The effect was as if two individual devils, a fiend of fire and a fiend of darkness, united themselves to form this infernal visage. I don't think it's pushing it too hard, but there clearly is a relationship here too, it seems to me, and Hawthorne would know this, and I think an American reader would recognise it too. This painted face business is very much like the Indians painting their faces, is it not? And a lot of the riot that occurs later is very much in Indian costume. Again and again at this time, in order to express revolt, people did dress as Indians. I mean, the famous Boston Tea Party, for starter, where the American people, in order to express their revulsion against the taxes the British were imposing, dressed up as Indians and threw the tea into the sea. The very curious thing is that the people who the Americans were exterminating, ever since the 1630s, when the Pequot tribe were exterminated in New England, this ambivalence that somehow the Indians are the area of to be resisted and oppressed. At the same time, they seem to be a symbol of energy and license, indigenous to the continent, through which you can symbolize the extermination of the British. It's a very ambivalent thing. A lot of books have been written about this, but we'll do with that some other time. So, we get to that point there. Notice that where Hawthorne says, as Robin looks into the street, the moon, creating like the imaginative power a beautiful strangeness in familiar objects, gave something of romance to the scene that might not have possessed in the light of day. Then the architecture, the old architecture, is given some kind of energy. But the basic thing is, for Robin, the indistinctness of things, ghostly indistinctness. His eye appeared to grasp them. This whole world for Robin is one of mystery, indecision, of him finding his way. This is what's being dramatized. You understand? Well, I think that's enough of that kind of material. What the story is moving forwards to is, in fact, the kind of carnival route in which Maid de Molyneux appears. And gradually, the interior plot of the story is to bring that figure he first of all sees in the tavern into the centre, this painted man, who he sees first of all not painted, into the centre. This fiendish-looking stranger is brought to the centre of the story. There's the meeting in the tavern, and the meeting in the street, and finally he becomes the image of war personified, is Hawthorne's phrase. Some kind of myth image of violence related to Indian war paint and the white imitation of this. That's like the interior plot here. And the prose is very, very complicated. There are quite long sentences, and we're developing this chiaroscuric sense of the labyrinth of streets, the light and dark, the mysterious feeling of hostility, and the laughter that follows him. It's beautifully done. I must say, I'm very impressed by this. Indeed, I think it's extraordinarily well done. Then, I think one of the most marvellous things that Hawthorne ever did, to have mine intensely, is when the gentleman who has befriended him said, "Sit down, Robin," and he sits down, and then the procession appears. The description is, to my mind, quite extraordinary. First of all, the shouts and the laughter are heard. They're coming not against Robin, as it were, but like still the laughter factor is involved in the story, was part of the din, which is increasing as it comes towards them. And then this extraordinary description of the torchlight overcoming the moonbeams. A redder light disturbed the moonbeams, and a dense multitude of torches shone along the street, concealing by their glare. And then the single horseman, clad in military dress, who is in fact this man again. The red on one cheek was an emblem of fire and sword, the blackness of the other betokened the mourning that attends them. And in his train were wild figures in the Indian dress, and many fantastic shapes without a model, giving the whole march a visionary air, as if a dream had broken forth from some feverish brain and was sweeping visibly through the midnight streets. And that dream is the dream of revolutionary violence, in fact. That's what it in fact means in the story. Well, I'm like pushing it rather hard, but that is in fact what it is. And the leader, and there's the most marvellous moment I just really love, where the leader turns in his saddle and fixes his glance full upon the country youth as the steed went slowly by. And then there's more shouting and laughter, and as you've read, that extraordinary moment when the kinsman finally appears. Right before Robin's eyes was an uncovered cart. There the torches blazed the brightest, there the moon shone out like day, and there in tar and feathery dignity sat his kinsman, Major Molyneux. He was an elderly man, a large, majestic person, and strong, square features betokening a steady soul. But steady as it was, his enemies had found means to shake it. His face was pale as death and far more ghastly. The broad forehead was contracted in his agony, so that his eyebrows formed one grizzled line. His eyes were red and wild, and the foam hung white upon his quivering lip. His whole frame was agitated by a quick and continual tremor, which his pride strove to quell, even in those circumstances of overwhelming humiliation. And then his eyes meet his kinsman. For the second time, the eyes meeting Robin. You see, first of all, the painted figure of war and Indianness, violence and revolution, and then the man who's been overthrown, his eyes meet Robin. The focus is Robin, you see, all the time. This boy's going to make decisions about these two figures, is the point. You see, he's grabbed by it. It seems to me, I can't stress it, I think it's extraordinary done. But then notice, Robin needs shook as he stared at, and his hair bristled with a mixture of pity and terror. And then the whole scene breaks. A perception of tremendous ridicule, and here's your laughter bit coming in again, do you see? A perception of tremendous ridicule in the whole scene affected him, Robin, with a sort of mental inebriety. Now this is the switch in the middle of the story, you know? Mental inebriety, I mean, he's like drunk. And his mind is overwhelmed, point of drunkenness, by the whole scene. You know, and that's just the move from pity and terror, you see, through to mental inebriety in like the two sentences. It's a marvellous, like, interior climax of the plot, you see, in that particular way. And then we get the next bit. At that moment, a voice of sluggish merriment, and here's your laughter again, saluted Robin's ears. And then a peal of laughter, like a ringing of silver bells. All the people he's met are laughing at him now, after this experience, again. A great broad laugh sails over their heads, and so on. And then, finally, it's called a contagion, notice. The contagion spreads among the multitude. When all at once it sees Robin. Now here, like, is the isolated youth is being like brought into the crowd through the laughter and the merriment at the condition of his kinsman and himself, but he's like able, and this is Hawthorne's point, to join into this laughter by the contagion, and he sends forth a shout of laughter that echoes through the streets. Every man shook his sides, every man emptied his lungs, but Robin's shout was the loudest there. And then there was a momentary calm in that tempestuous sea of sound. The leader gave the sign, and the procession resumed its march. It's all like there's been an arrestation of the movement, you see, and it's absolute laughter. The contagion of it, and Robin is brought in. Do you see what Hawthorne's trying to do? He's suggesting, like, this isn't a decision, it's a contagion. Robin still has to make the decision, do you see? This is like this is an example of unconscious activity. The inebriety suggests, doesn't it? You see, not will and decision, but the drunkenness, the intoxication. So it's a question of contagion and intoxication together that Hawthorne is concerned with. But you see, he's not making decisions for you about this. He says, on they went like fiends, that throng in mockery around some dead potentate, mighty no more, but majestic still in his agony. This isn't a ridicule, as far as Hawthorne's concerned, of Major Molyneux, do you see? Then we get, on they went, in counterfeited pomp, in senseless uproar, in frenzied merriment, trampling all on an old man's heart. On swept the tumult, and left a silent streak behind, and then back comes the silence with which the story starts. But notice that Hawthorne is there suggesting that you may not make easy decisions about this. These are human beings, you see, and this trampling on an old man's heart. It's a typical of Hawthorne's equasive, what I want to call his equasive movement. He wants to present information in a structure which holds it without making radical decisions continually. And then there's a pause, and Robin has sunk into some kind of reverie, and the man lays his hand upon his shoulder and says, the things that we looked at right at the beginning. And the story ends with a set of, like a sort of chord of information which sounds at the end of the story, you see, and then it stops. And that's in fact all there is. It's a kind of set of vibrations through there. Beautifully told, to my mind, and an exemplary structure. It's nearly the example of short story, to my mind, writing this. The structuring is very brilliant indeed. But notice that the structuring is at the for the purpose of showing a psychological moment and a historical moment fusing in the initiation of this boy, you see, in that way, given the setting. The other one, the birthmark, of course, is a very different cup of tea, because the social environment is not really, in this story, Hawthorne's concern. What he wants to do in the birthmark is something else, and the fact that the setting is the laboratory, basically, isn't it? I mean, I know there are other scenes in it, but the basic scene is the environment as laboratory, not the environment as an incipient revolutionary thing. So one wants to look then at the ways in which the scientist operates within this enclosed environment, because the laboratory is necessarily an enclosed experimental environment, isn't it, you see, is what he's concerned with here. The basis is Hawthorne's providing information about a man who mistakes science for religion. I mean by that he mistakes science to have the absolute enclosure of a religion. That is, I mean, if a religion is a fixed, you know, like structure, which includes dogma and belief and an imagic program and so on. If you substitute science for that, you in fact are in a power situation which you can apply your dogma to human beings. So it's a situation of controls. But notice too, it's a situation in which a human being is sacrificed to those controls in the name of science. So it's one of the many, many stories in the West about the ways in which a human being is sacrificed to a structure or a process of some kind, you see. Most science fiction in the 19th century dealt with this. A great deal of it today does, but not all of it. So there's the philosophic preoccupations in the story are in that opening paragraph again. You see how what Hawthorne is usually very, very clear and helpful in his information. He doesn't try and fox in the opening paragraph. The key ideas, I think, from which he's going to work are in the opening sentence, in the latter part of the last century, there lived a man of science, an eminent proficient in every branch of natural philosophy, who not long before our story opens have made experience of a spiritual affinity more attractive than any chemical one. And then we get, in those days when the comparatively recent discovery of electricity and other kindred mysteries of nature seemed to open paths into the region of miracle, so that like lines up the supernatural with science, you see, and gives that power. But notice there's a sexual thing going on immediately. In those days when the comparatively recent discovery of electricity and other kindred mysteries of nature seemed to be open the paths into the region of miracle, it was not unusual for the love of science to rival the love of woman in its depth and absorbing energy. And here's Hawthorne saying, science, religion, and love as an involved relationship of different kinds of energy structure, see here, descriptions of energy. And then we get the description of the scientist as one who would ascend from one step of powerful intelligence to another. It's like the old alchemists, remember, who like this went on like converting dross base metals right through to gold, which was a psychological process as well, as you know, because the alchemy is a very important matter. From one step of powerful intelligence to another, until the philosopher should lay his hand on the secret of creative force and perhaps make new worlds for himself. We know not whether Aylmer, that's the name of the scientist in the story, possessed this degree of faith in man's ultimate control over nature. But certainly the point is his scientific stories are moving in that direction. And so you have one of the major factors there of science fiction, do you not? That is the idea that you might lay your hand on the secret of creative force and make new worlds for yourself. Do you see? This is why the church attacked alchemy in the 16th and 17th century, particularly that the chances were if they found the secret of metamorphosis of energy, you would find the secret alive. It's like it's also the apprehension that we feel, do we not? Like today, when somebody we read in the paper that somebody has created life in a test tube or whatever, immediately there is this apprehensiveness about the fact that it can be done, which means that the man who does it has that kind of control over vital energy, which makes you nervous, does it not? You know, because one feels that, okay, how altruistic is this guy? you know, what's he going to do next? And like, who's paying him? Which is like, in America at the moment, one of the most important matters. Like they're challenging the university science department because they've been paid by the state again and again. And therefore, like, the control structure of political power. So Hawthorne is on to really essential matters here. A man's ultimate control over nature in the world of applied science and experimental technology in the 19th century was a major factor. And it's the centre of a great deal of fiction, and let alone philosophy and science. So that's the context, you see, which in the same way as in the other story, Hawthorne supplies the pre-revolutionary context, you see. Here he's supplying the context of what is the nature of scientific power when it begins to move into the area where it apparently can put its hand on the secret of creative force? Force, the word there, this time particularly, still is exchangeable with the word energy, meaning the vital center of nature. Now, immediately the moral issue is raised, because the person he's experimenting on is his wife. Not to say the sexual issue, it's like you start experimenting on your wife. Well, I suppose kinky would be a cheap word of putting it, but I mean, it's certainly odd, shall we say. And the title is extraordinary, because the suggestion in the opening paragraph, you see, of ultimate control, and is linked up with the going from one step of powerful intelligence to another. This is connected with the idea of perfection. That is the idea, which is quite a central human idea, which is of the ability to create the perfect thing. This is in Hawthorne's story, The Artist of the Beautiful, you know, that you want to create the ideal perfect butterfly. Not to imagine it, but to create it. Which means you've got to have your hand on energy, as this man said at the beginning, right? Now, if it's the perfect human being you want to connect, and there are lots of stories in the 19th century and the 20th century about this, the dream of genetic, it comes to later, genetic mutation, so that by systems of eugenics and other things, you perfect the human by crossbreeding. You know, this is how it is these days. The desire to produce the perfect human by science means. And it's still around, and one still feels apprehensive about it. And the blemish on the lady, you remember, is this birthmark on her cheek, which appears in certain emotional conditions rather stronger than at other times. And it's that that is to be eradicated, correct? You see? And so it's a perfectionist urge, is it not? Directed towards the human. Now this raises a variety of modern moral issues about manipulating basic energy in order to change it towards improvement and so on. Do you see? This is what Hawthorne is trying to dramatize here. So the philosophical preoccupations of the story then are very complexly moral, leading out from this idea of Aylmer, the hero, as a man of science, who wants to relinquish, we're told in the opening paragraph, the experience of chemical affinity for spiritual affinity. It's that vital move that Hawthorne's concerned with. And the implication is, again and again, in this kind of story, and here particularly, that it's a transgression to do that. There's a fundamental transgressing of a taboo here. So now, ironically then, Aylmer's confidence in his technical knowledge, the degree of faith in man's ultimate control over nature, is proved mistaken. As you know, you read the story, and I think you'll agree that what the outcome is, that the man of science can never be certain of his speculative results, and therefore should never use another human being for those experiments. This seems to be what Hawthorne's equation does. Aylmer murders his wife, or at least it's a controversion of laws amounting to a sort of careless manslaughter, but all in the name of experimental science, you see, and perfection is the point that Hawthorne is making here. Once you search for the secret of creative force, which is like the alchemist's elixir of life, you know, that kind of push, you're in this area. This is an obsessive theme in Hawthorne, I may say. Now, I must repeat that I chose the story very carefully. This idea of what it means when you say control of life. He really is in the center of that kind of vital modern description. So Aylmer's experiments are very carefully plotted in the story, you remember, for himself alone. It's as if his wife is inveigled into this, is it not? Don't you think? I mean, she's not really making radical decisions as a human being. Again, this involves, I think, the relationship between men and women. That there's another basic theme in Hawthorne's work, and in the 19th century generally. That is, in what sense, in the 19th century, are women property or usable elements? You know, this whole stuff about women being part of a man's prerogative. So this has the sexual overtone. You find it in Ibsen's The Doll's House, you know, and The Scarlet. I mean, there's a lot of writing about this, but of course very little was done about it until very recently. But the writers were there. So love of science then fuses quite fatally with love of his wife, which he wishes to produce, in whom he wishes to produce a perfection for his love. And we're here concerned with something else too, which is very important in the story and for us generally, and that is the difficulty, once you're in this this frame of sensibility, for some people at least, to ignore imperfections in another person, and somehow the imperfections get into the way of love, if you have that kind of idealistic program for the beloved. Do you see? That kind of thing. Now, D.H. Lawrence learned a lot from Hawthorne, by the way, and a lot of his material it deals with this idea of imagining perfection in another person and then being wrecked when you don't find it. Poe is interested in this one too. So the perfect is by its definition dead, and so the girl is bound, Georgiana is bound to die. I mean by that, if a thing is perfect, it suggests that it doesn't change, doesn't it? You see, because it's like it's arrived at its situation. So if you, in order to achieve the perfect, you have to kill the process. So he wishes to kill his wife, as it were, by making her an incarnate experimentee towards this confidence he has in his own power. And Georgiana at one point says to him, you cannot love what shocks you. And immediately the whole business of what is that, what is the psychology of love that enables most people to fall in love with somebody and fall in love with all of the person rather than the potential for perfection in that person. So there's an erotic interior to this plot of great importance. And Hawthorne is very clear on Aylmer's peculiar psychology. That is, that what other lovers find attractive, even sexually stimulating in his wife, you remember this thing about how she appears to other men going on, he finds a blemish. And Hawthorne's very aware that maybe a birthmark for some men on a woman's face is extremely attractive. You know, it's part of how this person is. Do you see? In this kind of way. It's a fact. But for him, it's a blemish on what the phrase is, ideal loveliness. Sounds like Shelley or something, doesn't it? Like, you know, who's always hoping that he'd find it. So I think that the erotic thing is very near the surface in this story. But that is the phrase that's used also for the thing that makes it unbearable in his wife's face is the fatal flaw of humanity. You know, this is loaded. It implies that in order not to have a fatal flaw, you have to be dehumanized. It's this terrifying urge for the absolute, for the ultimate, for perfection, for the fixed, complete thing which is not under in a process, do you see? This kind of thing that Hawthorne is dramatizing very carefully here. So this red sign, which in the shape of a small hand, signifies humanity and mortality together. So that the perfection signifies a kind of false immortality, which is what's going on. So this romantic love of Aylmer fuses into his science inclinations, and he moves to transform his wife into an object. It's a very strong theme in Poe, and a very strong theme in Lawrence too, who read all these people, of course. So she becomes a victim of idealism, I think is the best way to say it very quickly. That is that Georgiana dreams accurately. This is a strange use of dreams. You may not think it's legitimate. There's always a puzzle about using dreams, isn't there, in fiction? It seems to me like a sort of an intrusion on the private. If you know, like as a kind of manic completeness here. Do you want to have your character's dreams as well as everything else? Okay. Well, anyway, it's there. I'm not sure what I feel about this race, actually. Anyway, Georgiana dreams accurately that her birthmark extends right down into the heart of her life. Remember. And that its eradication means death caused by her husband's, and I quote, power to correct what nature left imperfect. Now there are two definitions here of activity. The idea that nature itself is imperfect, and the idea that there's something in human nature which reaches for the perfect, and therefore has to change nature. You see, there are two things quite parallel here, which Hawthorne is concerned with. So, into the laboratory with his wife, in order to get going on this one. And remember that the scene is now got up as a luxury apartment, which is artificially lit. It's quite hidden from sunlight, is the point. It's quite deliberate, remember, that there is no sunlight getting into this area. And the sunlight, it really is the, I mean, it's the source of life for human beings, ultimately. Because everything you eat depends on sunlight, for a start off. So there's this enclosed area, do you see? It's not just a laboratory, because you have a laboratory, it's open to the sun. This is an enclosed laboratory. And that's where the sacrificial act has to take place. Do you notice that third party involved in all this? The man called Aminadab. Remember? The sort of, I nearly said slave, but I mean the dark-skinned helper, shall we say, to be euphemistic. You remember, he's a stocky, shaggy dwarf of great physical strength. And I don't think one needs to be too insistent about it, but clearly, you know, just think of the number of strong, shaggy dwarves in, like, Grimm's fairy tales and all these other stories who are embodiments of energy, and like earth energy, you know, this kind of area. It's a constant in human myth-making and story-making. And he does all Aylmer's physical work for him. He has a division of labor which cuts right into the 19th century. You know, you have a class of managers and scientists and fiddle-dee-dees of that kind, and then you have, like, the workers. And Hawthorne is very strong on this one in all his stories. And if they're black workers, you have a bit more. Which, like, you know, I don't want to let you stress, but it's there. It's a further indication then of the kind of things going on in this story. You've got this pale cerebrality of the man of science in search of what he calls the golden principle for its own sake. And with him working this stocky, shaggy, strong dwarf. I find there's a little bit, something a bit unsatisfactory to me. I don't know whether I'm reading it badly, this story, but I do find Georgiana terribly, sort of a patient Griselda sort of figure, you know. One wonders why she doesn't do damage along the line somewhere, like fight for her rights or whatever. But obviously it's ridiculous to say that, because that isn't how the story is. But she does say, remember, it is terrible to possess such power, or even to dream of possessing it. Which is all the time you get this awful frustration that the girl understands what's going on, but the relationship with Aylmer is such for her that she can't do a thing for it. So Aylmer realizes that the birthmark isn't superficial, and he realizes, from what his wife says and what he knows, that he is tackling a very a problematic psychosomatic thing. But Hawthorne's point, I think, is that he tackles it in the spirit of dehumanized research. Into the limits of natural possibility is the phrase, do you see? The limits of natural possibility. He does it without a sense of wonder or reverence for life, to use the great phrase of Schweitzer. And so she really offers herself as an object for experimentation, finally, submitting to power which she knows is dangerous, but which she considers, in her words for him, pure and lofty. And there's an extraordinary passage which one has to sort of face. She felt how much more precious was such a sentiment than the meaner kind which would have borne with the imperfection for her sake, and have been guilty of treason to holy love by degrading its perfect idea to the level of the actual. And with her whole spirit she prayed that for a single moment she might satisfy his highest and deepest conception. Longer than one moment she knew well it could not be, for his spirit was ever on the march, ever ascending, and each instant required something that was beyond the scope of the instant before. She she moves into, quite consciously then, this area that she knows darn well, that she is part of an endless process of discovery and experimentation. There's this conflict, to my mind, in the story, which one has to accept, between what she knows and what she accepts. And she drinks that potion, which is a kind of parody of all those love potions and magic potions in the stories throughout the history of myths and fiction of the world. And notice that a lesson to all scientists: it works on a geranium, but it kills her. Like, you know, there's one for Mr. Blyber to work out. And the red hand vanishes, and her life with it. You know, it's like all those scientists: oh, it works on rats, like, kind of custom. Why doesn't it work on humans? Like, I'm glad it was a geranium because that's red as well. I know, I'm mean. And then it gets a bit kind of sort of gothic-y with Aminadab, like with his gross hoarse chuckle and this ironic laughter of what's going on. And it's he who says, if she were my wife, I'd never part with that birthmark. And Hawthorne is like playing off here the sort of dark, earthy assistant who's right, but isn't a brain, and doesn't have that perfection knowledge, you see. It's like the proletarians are going to win bit going on here, which is very strong throughout 19th century literature. This feel that maybe there is a power beyond pale cerebrality that will be victorious. This comes up, believe me, again and again and again, not only in American. So let's like say it, let's level it off, because the implications are very strong here, particularly as an American story, that we have here this victor of the story. The victor of the story is, of the drama, is the physical servant, who from his name is apparently the Oriental Indian, technically a black man. And he who has the last charcoal bit. It's a story then which is in fact a dramatic scheme of very, very important elements, very carefully done. And the obvious answer to my rather puling little objections to the condition of Georgiana is that it wouldn't have seemed very salutarily unpleasant to most people reading it in the 19th century, because like this is how women appeared in fiction so often, did they not? You know, as areas to be used as property or prostitution or like as part of the man's world, and therefore his prerogative, you know, continually. So I think it's part of that. But it's very curious to read this, because when he comes to write The Scarlet Letter, it's exactly that that's challenged. Because the whole point about Hester Prynne, the heroine of The Scarlet Letter, is that she challenges exactly that male prerogative. And she becomes what it was called in the 19th century, emancipated woman. Okay, she's still isolated from the community, but at least she makes it along her own lines in that way, and knows what sexual love is, and knows what intelligence is. And very few heroines in the 19th century fiction know that together. Because it's usually, the male author usually says, okay, if she's sexy, I'm going to deprive her of intelligence. If she's intelligent, I am not going to let her in bed with anybody. You know, or if she does, she suffers. You know, that's how terrible polarization goes on throughout 19th century fiction for the ladies, as you probably noticed. It goes on an awful lot these days too. Like I was looking at an old movie the other day by Ayn Rand, who's a beastly American woman, who wrote a thing called The Fountainhead, and the women all suffer, like, because, you know, they're intellectuals, like, and they've got to suffer in bed, all the other way around. Isn't that true? You know. So that's the kind of thing. I was just asking, was it true about Ayn Rand? Watch it. Right. Okay. Well, that
is the birthmark before or after Frankenstein?
Oh Lord. Oh, after, of course. Yeah, Mary Shelley is before it. Yes, yes. Oh, you know, like Mary Shelley story, Mary Shelley stuff, and that. Well, I must be careful, because it won't do to talk about before and after John, because there's a whole antecedent backlog here of Gothic fiction. Yeah. You see, I must